Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senziano, host of the Jake and Gino podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbo. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, I'm doing good. And before you introduce this guest, I will pronounce his last name because I know you've got no shot at pronouncing it. So if you want to pronounce his first name.
What are you talking about? Go ahead, Gino. Brother. What you got?
His name is Will Guidara. What a beautiful Italian name. It's supposed to roll off the tongue.
He said Will Guidara.
Yeah, brother. You see that? Love it.
Well, without further ado, we have Will Guidara on the show, who happens to be a national bestseller for his book, Unreasonable Hospitality. I think you need to be unreasonable these days when it comes to hospitality. It's few and far between. And he's out there teaching companies to be more creative and intentional in building relationship capital with the people they work with and the people they serve. So, without further ado, officially, Will Guidara, welcome to the show.
My dad is going to feel so proud of how our last name was pronounced. And I'm going to tell you, if that is the right way to pronounce my name, I've been pronouncing it so wrong for so many years.
Well, last names aside, let's get into the business end of it a little bit. At least give us a brief overview of your background and how you got started.
Yeah, so I'm a restaurant guy. I have been my entire life. My dad was a restaurateur, so I grew up in it. I've literally, outside of one summer where I was an arts and crafts counselor at my high school summer camp, I've only ever worked in restaurants. So from the age of, very, very young, working for free for my dad, and then starting at 14, I've worked pretty much every position you can imagine in restaurants across the country. That took me to the point where I owned my own company called Make It Nice. We had restaurants in New York, LA, Vegas, London, the Hamptons, Aspen, but we were perhaps most known for our restaurant, 11 Madison Park, which when I got there, because I worked there for a while before buying it, was kind of like a middling two-star brasserie. But by the time I sold my company, just before COVID, it had earned 4 stars in the New York Times, 3 Michelin stars, and was named the number one restaurant in the world. And I attribute that success to the fact that we made the choice to be as unreasonable in pursuit of how we were making people feel as every other restaurant was in pursuit of just the product they were selling them. And so that's why I wrote this book, is to really kind of put that out into the world, that hospitality and choosing to be relentless in your pursuit of it is an unfair competitive advantage for any company across discipline that decides to make it a priority.
For the YouTubers, I'm holding the book up. It is an amazing book, and I have a lot of admiration and respect and love for Will because I was the former pizza guy, and I owned a restaurant in New York for over 20 years, and I know how soul-sucking and how difficult the business can be, and I wish I had Will's vision when I had the restaurant because, to me, I lost the vision of serving the customer. It was only about serving my family and serving myself. And then when I pulled myself out of it and I got into multifamily and I started to understand that, okay, we have 1,800 units, but those are 1,800 residents. Those aren't, you know, units. Those are apartment homes. Once I started taking that, I wish I could have gone back into my restaurant days because I was in it since I was 8 years old. My father was the restaurant guy. And I looked at it more as a business than a calling. And that was so challenging for me. Then when I left, I had that regret. But thankfully, I met Jake and I started to understand what business truly meant. In the book, you have so many beautiful examples of unreasonable hospitality. Can you share a couple of stories? The one that sticks out with me is the hot dog. I mean, having people come into your restaurant and spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars and to be able to create that beautiful experience, or actually leaving cognac after the meal is prepared. Those little touches that go a long way. Or the couple that left the champagne bottle in the freezer and you let, you know, the person from the restaurant go out and take it out of the freezer so it wouldn't explode, and then leave a little tin of caviar. These are all little things that may cost money, but you are creating amazing experiences and you're creating something that people will remember forever, Will.
Yeah. No. Well, thank you, man. I appreciate that. I mean, you know, the hot dog was kind of our origin story. around this philosophy, which was that I had the words unreasonable hospitality in my head as the impact that I felt we had an opportunity to make on our industry. But I wasn't sure what that meant. By the way, I think that that happens a lot. At least for me, I think too many people spend so much time trying to perfectly articulate a goal that they never start pursuing anything. I think if you have an idea and you feel enough of a connection to it, you need to trust in the fact that as you pursue it, it will reveal itself to you along the way. And so I had this idea of unreasonable hospitality in my head, and we were pursuing it and not quite finding it. And then one day, and this has become kind of the famous story from the book, I was in the dining room helping out the servers. I was clearing appetizers from a table of four foodies. They were on vacation to New York. They were just there to eat at restaurants. This is their last meal. They were going to the airport to head back home right after their lunch. And I overheard them talking about all the amazing meals they'd had. They'd been to Le Bernardin and Danielle and Per Se, now 11 Madison Park. And then one woman jumped in and said, yeah, but you know what we never had a New York City hot dog. And overhearing that, it was like one of those light bulb moments in a cartoon. I ran out of the restaurant, grabbed a hot dog, ran back into the kitchen. Then came the hard part, which was convincing my fancy chef to serve it in our fancy restaurant.
Wait, but what point of the meal was this, though? Because if they're like cashing out or whatever.
Appetizers.
Oh, this was, so you got them early enough. Okay.
We got them early. We had plenty of time. But I eventually convinced him. We cut the hot dog up into perfect pieces and made it look super fancy with swishes of mustard and ketchup. And before their final savory course, which was a honey lavender glazed Muscovy duck that had been dry aged for 2 weeks, I brought out what we in New York call a dirty water dog to the table.
That thing had been dry aged for months.
That's a wet aging, actually. Yeah. That's aged.
That's
in
a
water.
Wet aging. That's a soaking. That's a soaker, right?
That's a nice soaker. And I explained, I said, hey, I wanted to make sure you didn't go home with any culinary regrets. Here's that hot dog. And guys, they freaked out. I would say that, you know, athletes always go to the tapes and they've had a bad game to see what they did wrong. They don't often enough go to the tapes and they've had a good game to see what they did well to make sure that they keep on doing that thing so that they can put systems behind it to make sure that it happens all the time. And when I went back to the tapes and the hot dog, it was three things. It was being present, like not worrying about efficiency or what I needed to do next, just being fully with them when I was doing the most menial of tasks, clearing their dirty plates. It was not taking myself too seriously. This happens all the time in customer service where we let these self-imposed standards, how we're supposed to act, get in the way of us doing the things that will actually bring the most joy to those around us. A hot dog in a four-star restaurant is ridiculous until you look at how it made them feel. And three, listen, I like to redefine hospitality every year because I think the better you are at articulating an idea, the better you are at motivating those around you to embrace it. One of my favorite definitions of hospitality is that it is about making people feel seen. And if that's the case, the best way to do it is not to treat people like a commodity, but as unique individuals. I really do believe I could have given that table a bottle of vintage Dom Perignon and it would not have had the same impact as the $2 hot dog because it would not have been specific to them.
They weren't looking for it.
Well, yeah, like if people feel seen, that you listened, you cared enough to listen to what they were saying and then to do something with what you heard.
Because it's the complete opposite of what you get day in and day out, though. No one cares. The constant feeling you get from interacting with businesses and society is that no one gives a shit. And so that's why it's so unique and stands out.
Well, and everyone just digs into the same toolkit. Yeah. And it like reinforces this belief system that in unreasonable hospitality, one size fits one. The best gestures are bespoke to the person receiving them. Mm-hmm. And so Gino, you talk about all these different things we did. That's just because I put a system behind the hot dog. And I gave my team the permission and the resources to do the same thing. And we added a position to the restaurant. We called it the Dreamweaver, named after the iconic song by Gary Wright, which was playing the first time I French kissed a girl back in the day.
Watching Wayne's World.
Yeah, exactly. And with that, we were on fire. And we did stuff like that constantly. Sleds for kids who had never seen snow. Beach scenes in our private dining room. Wedding dances for a couple that got married at City Hall after their wedding got canceled. I mean, and here's the cool part. Now let's shut up for a sec. I think unreasonable hospitality is a triple threat. The first case, yeah, we made a lot of people super happy, obviously. We're doing this kind of thing for people. They feel seen. They're having a blast. It's good for the guest. It's good for the bottom line. Yeah, we spent money on this stuff, but every dollar we spent on this was much more impactful than any dollar we ever spent on traditional marketing, because you give people stories like this to tell, they're going to tell them over and over again. But three, it was great for us. Because it feels good to make people happy. And it gave every single person on my team an element or a measure of creative autonomy that they never had before. Before, they were just serving plates of food that someone else got to be creative in designing. Now they got to be creative in the experience they were serving.
Talk about the systems behind it.
I mean, the main system is building resources. Right? So those resources came in a few different ways. One, literally a person in the dining room every single night that was just there to bring ideas to life, right? Like going above and beyond, giving people a little extra is all well and good. But in most organizations, people are at capacity and you can't go above and beyond when you have no margin. And so effectively creating margin. And so that if someone had an idea, they weren't dismissing that idea because it would, as we say in the restaurant business, put them in the weeds. We made it easy for them to go above and beyond. It also involved resources in the form of a toolkit. So we did simple pattern recognition where we just looked at the things that happened often. And if you can identify the recurring moments, the patterns in your business, not the things that happen every day for every one of your customers, but the things that happen once a week, once a month. If you can identify those and then in advance with some creativity and intention, decide how you'll respond. If necessary, invest a little money in building whatever assets you need to respond. Then you make it lightning fast and extraordinarily easy for your team to deploy those things. An example, I told you those guests were on their way to the airport right after their meal. That was a thing that happened a lot at our restaurant. Probably once every 2 weeks, someone was dining there on their way to the airport. And so once you identify that pattern, we made these beautiful boxes. We worked with a graphic designer. They said, I love Madison Park airplane food. Anytime we knew someone was going to the airport, we would just give them one of those boxes filled with delicious foods that they could eat well on the plane. It wasn't less special for the person receiving it because some other people had gotten it before. It was still specific to them in that moment and remarkably easy to deploy. You didn't have to run outside to get a hot dog. Those would be the two most probably impactful systems.
Will, how do you see AI affecting hospitality, because it's an efficient thing. You're taking the human out of it, but you're taking the human out of it and you're taking that connection out of it.
I think it falls purely on the approach that's taken in its integration. Mm-hmm. I think it either decimates hospitality or supercharges it. It is either used as something to replace humans, or it is given to humans as one of the most exceptional tools we could ever have in our toolkits. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is we spent so much time documenting the people that we were serving such that we could remember all the little things about them and use those things to make their next experience even better. I mean, there's already so many AI tools that you guys came into my restaurant, I could probably just run your names through a thing and know a few salient points about you that would make you feel like a regular in my restaurant from the moment you came in for the first time. But it does require it being a tool for humans, not a replacement for humans.
Mm-hmm.
So they pull it up and they say, Jake, would you like that Coors Light again today, sir? Oh, that would be lovely. That'd be great. Can we go back though to the Dreamweaver? I wasn't necessarily ready to move on from that yet. I feel like that position would come with a lot of stress and pressure because, you know, you're always trying to recreate the hot dog scene. And the hot dog scene is great, but if I come up short of not creating the hot dog scene every night, I'm going to feel like I missed. And it's almost like you're trying to create that spectacular moment every night, and it's that kind of level of creativity can be challenging.
Well, I would say two things. First, just a matter of logistics here. It's not the Dreamweaver's responsibility to come up with all these ideas, right? They're one Dreamweaver in an entire dining room. Yeah. It's the person, if I am your server, I'm the one spending time with you. I'm the one mm-hmm. present with you. It's up to me to figure out what would make your experience more special. The Dreamweaver is just there to execute on my behalf.
That's fair.
And so everything does not sit on one person's shoulders because no individual has endless creative bandwidth.
Like going around mm-hmm. listening to the table. Wait, what do you say?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you
exactly.
say?
Exactly.
That's not creepy.
And that's creepy as opposed to me just being present as I engage you in conversation.
Hey, Dreamweaver, I got an idea. Come on over here, man. I could be a part of this real quick.
I mean, the other thing is that a big gesture isn't right for everyone. Mm-hmm. And sometimes unreasonable hospitality is just leaving people alone. Right. And so it's not always about more is more. The entire thesis is that more thoughtful is more. But the real thing, like when you develop this kind of culture, the environment becomes electric and you can feel the energy and enthusiasm overflowing in every single person that works there. And so even if you come in and you don't get some sort of crazy hot dog gesture, the service and hospitality you receive is going to be so much greater because it is happening in the room around you. There's an infectiousness when it comes to thoughtfulness and generosity that can be felt by everyone, even if you're not directly on the receiving end mm-hmm. of some wild and crazy thing.
Will, how do you, this may seem like a pretty obvious question and answer to you and to Jake, but how do you train people to be more present? Because it's a lot difficult for the younger generation because we're always being bombarded by messages and there's always noise going around and just trying to be silent and just trying to listen to somebody and trying to be in that conversation. How would you train somebody to do that?
Well, I think that we talk in business too often about training and not nearly enough about encouraging. Mm-hmm. I've found in my experience that it's much easier to encourage good behavior than train it. And how you encourage it is through affirmation and through criticism, right? Like helping people do something once. Like, I believe the moment you do one of these gestures for someone and you feel that surge of energy that comes from seeing the look on someone else's face when they receive a gift you're responsible for giving them, that very quickly becomes an addiction, something you want over, you want another hit of that feeling. And so if you can help people, to go too far down this metaphor, get their first taste, right, then it starts to become self-perpetuating. And then your role is just to teach them how to be better at achieving it. But if I just like sit in a training manual, tell you this, as opposed to just like speaking very, very passionately about it and remembering that as a leader, your role is to let your energy impact those around you, not the other way around. And if you talk about something with passion and enthusiasm enough, it becomes on its own infectious. Mm-hmm. And it just becomes a flywheel. Right? Speaking with passion, helping people get there once they have their first taste, encouraging them and showing them how to do it more often. And when it comes to behaviors that you're trying to get people to embody, this is one of the lighter lifts because anything that feels good when you finally go to do it is a lot easier to feel motivated to want to do again.
This sounds Jake, this sounds like this will be a core value, though. Being present is one of those five core values that, you know, any that your company would embrace. I mean, that would, that's one of the ways. And you, like you said, it becomes your mission to live through those core values. So I'm sorry, Jake, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, let's have him evaluate the percent repaired thing that we came up with last week. So had an epiphany, and in our space, it's very common for teams to talk about percent occupied. Right. You know, occupancy of the apartment complex. Right. It's just something everyone knows. And everyone's like, oh, how, where's your occupancy? It's just, you know, industry lingo that I'm sure you're familiar with as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, for ourselves, as we're trying to create quality homes and quality service for our residents, that that's the mission that we're on. And so I said to the team last week that you have kind of, you know, to use, you know, your sports reference, you have kind of two sides of the ball. Right. You have offense and defense. And it's terrible, and we're never going to reach this goal of great service, quality homes, and quality service if we don't look at the service side as much as the leasing and whatnot. Because everyone, you know, you could ask in the organization, what's your occupancy? Everyone knows. But can you ask a maintenance tech, for example, what his percent repaired is? And well, what the hell is that? So I said to the team last week, I said, we should look at the number of work orders we have and the amount of units and calculate the percent repaired on a consistent basis to ensure that that is as important as the percent occupied. Because yes, it's important. You have to bring the money in and everything. But if we're not servicing the people, you know, that unit's going to be vacant because they're going to be leaving because they're not getting taken care of. So we're actually in the process of instituting a percent repaired, which is just the number of units and the outstanding work orders. And the benchmark there, just like the occupancy, needs to be above 95% starting out. So thoughts on that?
I mean, you didn't leave me margin to not like it because you called it an epiphany when you started it off, right? So, like, if I said anything negative right
now. It sucks.
Dude, no, but bring it on, because if I'm doing something stupid, like, I can take it like a big boy and maybe I'll learn from it. Because no, if I'm not learning, I'm going to stay a dummy, right? So hit me, man.
No, but it has the added benefit of being something that I adore. And I'll tell you why. I don't think that many people running companies understand the crazy impact to the end user when they decide what they are going to measure. In most organizations, what gets measured gets managed. It is only the thing that you measure that the people on your team are going to spend any time focusing on, because we are, whatever, bonused, given raises, hired, fired, based on these measurable things, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, if the only thing you're measuring is occupancy, that's going to be the only thing that people actually genuinely really care about. And so making the choice to start measuring the part of your business that is effectively whether or not you're keeping the promise you made to people when they moved in, I think is extraordinary.
Never heard of it, though. And obviously, rentals and apartments have been around for years, but never heard anyone say this. And I'm like, this needs to be as important, if not more important, than your occupancy.
And the said,
well, I would say more important.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right, more important. Because if you get those numbers up, occupancy will follow. The reverse is not true.
Yeah.
One is more of a scalable focus than the other. I love it.
This
A-plus. A-plus, Jake.
This
I'm going to get a hot dog.
This podcast would not be a Jake and Gino podcast about hospitality and customer service without mentioning Chick-fil-A. So I had to be Jake to the Chick-fil-A analogy. But, Will, what are some of your favorite companies that really endure and embrace this unreasonable hospitality? Can you give us a couple of examples? And maybe why you think they embrace that unreasonable hospitality? Or how?
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a bunch of time with Chick-fil-A this year. I agree. They're awesome. And so I like them being on the list. Chewy. You guys know Chewy? Is
that that you have box that shows up at my house all the time?
Remarkable, yes. Remarkable hospitality company. And you talk about like pattern recognition and then systemizing in what to do when certain things happen. I mean, if you have not talked to someone who is a Chewy customer who lost their pet, I mean, it's remarkable. Flowers immediately sent to you a week after you canceled.
Bring
your
them on,
ongoing
Chewy.
Delivery.
I've been waiting for the day to come. I want it over with. I want it over with. Come on, Chewy.
I'm gonna send you flowers too, brother. You're getting flowers from me too when that day happens. Okay.
Zappos, you know Zappos. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Tony Hsieh's company. Yes,
remarkable. Like, I mean, they have. I have this whole belief system around rules. Rules are necessary, obviously, to prevent like utter chaos in our organizations, but they also stand in the way of great hospitality and employee empowerment. And in most organizations, rules are just added and added and added and never taken away. And I think it should actually go in the other direction, where every company on earth should have an annual rules audit where you have to go through every rule and prove that it still deserves to exist. And I think customer service would change as we know it. One rule that exists in most people, in most companies with call centers, is a call center agent is measured on how many calls they complete on a daily basis. And obviously, if a call service agent only completes 2 calls a day, someone up at the top doesn't think they're making their money. And so they'll cap the number of minutes you're meant to spend on a phone call. Chewy does not, or Zappos does not. And there's like legends of a call service agent spending 8 hours on the phone with one disgruntled customer, just because that's what they determined was needed to help the person through whatever they were going through.
Damn,
those
that's
are two
expensive
companies.
Pair of sneakers at that point, huh?
but again, it's amortized over every other customer. Because that happened once, and I'm talking about it on your podcast.
I'm speaking
right now,
I'm speaking on behalf of the person calling in for the sneakers, right? Like at some point, like you got to look at yourself and say, "I just spent eight. I could have bought how many more pairs of sneakers if I applied myself to working?"
Dude, they just saved a couple thousand bucks on therapy. You kidding me, man? They're going, "Thanks, Zappos. I didn't have to go to my therapist for the rest of the month." You know what I mean?
There you go. That's what it is.
So those are the two that jump to mind.
My last question before we get to the short answers is remote work and, you know, working from online. How do companies and do companies struggle more, do you think, with hospitality by trying to create that culture in the organization?
I mean, my answer is going to be similar to the AI one. It depends who's leading that company. Mm-hmm. The reality is what it means to be a great leader has changed many, many times over the course of history, right? Back in the day, like a great leader was just the person with the confidence and conviction to say to people, this is where we're going, and people crave leadership. And so they would follow. And then eventually that was no longer enough. People wanted to be told where they were going and inspired why they should want to go there. And so a great leader was the person that delivered the what and the why, right? And then that was no longer enough because people want to feel some sense of ownership in where they're going. And so people wanted to be told what we're doing, why we should want to do that, and to feel invited to the table, even in the smallest of ways, to determine how they were going to do that together. Mm-hmm. In this new remote hybrid workplace, that's not even enough anymore. Because the sense of community within a team that is required to unlock their collective creativity and capacity, it doesn't happen organically like it once did around the proverbial water cooler or after work during happy hour. The leader now needs to create the conditions for that sense of connection with intention. And that can be done remotely. You can do things on a Zoom or whatever, but it just requires the leader being a good host and hosting their people such that they develop the kind of trusting bonds that unlocks their ability to do things that are great. Listen, I don't think there's ever going to be a world where us connecting in this way would replace how much closer we would feel to one another if we were doing this in the same room. But you can get pretty far down the line if you approach it in the right way.
Mm-hmm. All right, gang, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Now, we have had a great run in multifamily, going from zero units to over 250 million in assets. That's over 2,000 apartment deals that we've been able to purchase through our framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right.
Now, Jake and I, we created the Jake and Gino community back in 2015. We launched our first book, Yield Our Profits. And since then, our students have closed over 60,000 units. That's over $4 billion in assets they've been able to close over the last 6 years.
And that's why this community has been so successful. We call it results-based education, and we pour back into the community everything that we've learned on our journey from zero to 2,000 units and all our systems and scale that we use on our very own property management and investing companies.
Jake, I love that. It's not just education, it's implementation. So what I want you to do, click on that link down below, apply to work with our team, see how we can help you on your journey. Multifamily.
All right, we're back. It caught my ear early on. You said you were able to sell your restaurant right before COVID. That had to be a blessing, and I would just love to hear you speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, man. I mean, wild timing, not due to some prescient knowledge of the world's pending collapse. I am patient zero. No, it just worked out that way. And I feel grateful that it did.
So, Gino and yourself both sold your restaurants right at the beginning of 2020. So congratulations to both of you guys. You dodged a bullet by the skin of your teeth. And I'll just leave it at that.
There you go, Gino. I didn't know that. Congratulations.
Yeah. We opened the restaurant in 1994. I left in the year 2016 to go full-time into real estate with Jake. My brother still had it. And in February of 2020, we sold. And it was a blessing in disguise because it was a smaller place. My brother probably would not have been able to handle it by himself with all the rules up in New York. And one of the things that really bothered me about that whole situation was it was my family restaurant. It was my dad. It was my brother. And after 20 years, you have your life in it. And then they come in and tell you, you can't open. You can't serve your customers. And that was a death blow to a lot of small businesses back in 2020. I'm not saying they were right or they were wrong, but not to take that into consideration and to think that you have your entire legacy. Everyone in Mayapak knew Gino's Trattoria. We were part of the community. We were interwoven into the community. And to have that sort of possibly taken away would have really devastated me mentally. Even though I had left, my family was still there. And we were just fortunate to leave and sell it at the end of COVID, beginning of COVID. I'm sorry.
Mm. Yeah. It's crazy. It was a crazy time.
The scaling of service is something that I think is its own separate, you know, scale, if you will, because you're starting to scale your business. You're getting it underway. You're able to provide service, you know, your general service to customers. Where did you start in your journey to actually start to ramp that up? Because I think it takes people, systems, and culture to come together to actually start to do that. So can you speak to that a little bit?
I mean, listen, I think you start with, let me see. I'm trying to prioritize.
Because it's not that you didn't have service from the beginning. It's not like that. But I think there's an attention. And for us, there's almost a march saying, hey, we got to start going towards this and identified it as an organization. So I don't know if there was that kind of inflection point in your organization where you did the same thing.
While you're thinking of that, I can give Jake a great example in your book. Fine dining was all about doing the things in a certain way to do it. And Will went against the grain. He's like, you know what? Those are the old rules. Let me bring the new rules into it and think about customers and what they want. And let me try to bring expectations of what my team wants to do. And I think when I was reading that in the book, I'm like, that's pretty cool because there are certain things and certain elements and certain people that want to follow the old way, the old rules. And if you're just really focusing on delivering that superior customer service to your us to our residents or to your clients in the restaurant, you're already deviating from it. And I think that's one way I think that's one part of his journey where he said to himself, I'm doing it my way.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I also think, I mean, people, systems, and culture, it's a flywheel, and any amount of time or energy you spend focusing on one perpetuates the others, right? Like you focus on finding the right people And without even getting to the culture starts to improve because you have the right ingredients in the recipe. You focus on the culture. It starts to give everyone a sense of satisfaction and pride in the work they are doing, which not only brings even better things out of the people you already have, but helps you attract even better people. You focus on the systems that result in great service and hospitality happening, regardless of the inherent hospitality of the person on the front line. And people start to experience the magical feeling of providing graciousness to other people. And so they want to do it more even outside of the systems. And so I love that you said those three words, because it really is, I think people undervalue the importance of systems when it comes to hospitality. Too many people think hospitality is this like lovey-dovey thing that just happens because you find the happiest person to work on your team. Now you find good people, you make them great through culture, and then you make it more actionable and easy to deploy through systems.
I completely agree. It's a lot of work, that's for sure. All right, what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you?
On LinkedIn or Instagram is where people can generally follow what I'm working on, W. Gadara, on both platforms. I do a newsletter that I send out every 2 weeks called Premeal. Premeal is the 30-minute meeting we have in the restaurant right before we open the doors. I think it's the most important 30 minutes of the day in a restaurant when approached in the right way. And that means focusing on the how and the why more than just the what. And so that newsletter is where I kind of share little moments of inspiration that I've run into out in the world. Basically what I would be talking about in Premeal with my team every day if I still owned a restaurant. So that's a great thing for people who have read the book and want a little bit more to sign up for. And you can do that at unreasonablehospitality.com.
Awesome. All right, Gino, take us home.
A young Will Guidara. It was a fateful day. He was 12 years old, the first time he had gone to the Tavern on the Green. And that set the stage for the remainder of his life up until today. Talking about sitting in that restaurant with his pops and looking around and going, this is unbelievable. I've never experienced something like this. And for me, when reading the book, thinking that that was where he got his unreasonable hospitality. And then the example of his father, very similar to mine, being a hard worker, going to work in the morning, taking care of his mom, working 15 hours, coming back home, being really diligent with his time, not understanding how hard his dad was working, but at the same time, being able to take care of his mom, take care of his responsibilities, do really well at work. And then his dad watching Will go through the stages of his life, working at these amazing restaurants, then going to work with his dad's company for a little bit, then going to working at the Museum of Modern Art, and then going back to going to 11 Madison Park and seeing the journey. And everyone thinks that Will may be an overnight success, but over the last 20 years, putting in his time from being a lowly busboy to being a dishwasher, to moving up to a cook line, to working to front of the house and really learning all of the aspects of the business, to being able to sell his business, taking a 2-star 11 Madison Park to all the way to 4 stars and one of the best restaurants, if not the best restaurant in the world. It takes a lot of dedication. It takes a lot of effort, and it takes unreasonable hospitality. Thanks, Will.
Ooh. Well said, Gina.
That was awesome. Gino, I don't know whether Jake would have done as good a job, but my instinct is no. I don't think he could have touched
it's not,
that one.
It's not my thing. I don't do it. That's why I leave it up to the professional. I leave it up to the professional. So well done, Gino. And gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's the G-Daddy, and we make it happen. We'll see you next time. Thanks, Will.